Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy to see if you could save when you bundle your home and auto policies. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and this is my special segment that is weekly now called The Weekly Docket, where I recap the top true crime stories in the headlines this week. So this week, we're covering a range of stories from a horrific bullying video in Hawaii to a high-profile CEO's murder suspect becoming kind of an unlikely cult figure, and then also a influencer who was shot dead while she was recording a live stream. So let's go ahead and get into it. One of the most upsetting viral videos this week comes from the town of Wahiawa on Oahu, Hawaii. In the disturbing clip, a 21-year-old woman with special needs is seen being brutally attacked by a group of teenagers, an assault so vicious that it left viewers across the islands and the mainland outraged. The video shows the young woman, a former Leilahua high school student, being punched and kicked in the head while she's on the ground, unable to defend herself. In the footage, at least four other young adults are surrounding her, egging on the violence as someone films the entire incident without ever stepping in. The exact timing of the assault is unclear, but it was posted to social media recently, and then it spread like wildfire, sparking immediate anger among the community. Then, in an almost cinematic turn of events, some outraged community members took it upon themselves to hunt down the suspected attackers, and they live-streamed their search on Instagram for the world to see. And at one point, roughly 11,000 people were watching the Instagram live as these vigilante students drove around naming suspected bullies and demanding that they turn themselves in. It was really a dramatic display of community fury. One could hear the emotion in their voices on the live stream, and furious that a vulnerable young woman from their own community who has special needs had been targeted in such a cruel and horrific way. The fact that thousands of people tuned in real time just shows how deeply this incident resonated far beyond just the local high school. By Wednesday night, this grassroots pressure seemed to kind of dovetail with official action, and the Honolulu Police Department, or HPD, confirmed that they had arrested four individuals in connection with the attack, three of whom were minors. The suspects include a 13-year-old boy, two girls ages 14 and 16, and an 18-year-old woman. Why is an 18-year-old hanging out with kids like that? I don't know. Anyway, all are believed to either be current or former students of Leilahua High School, and the school's administration quickly sent a letter to parents acknowledging the off-campus incident and promising full cooperation with the police. As of now, HPD says that charges are pending against the arrested teens, Potentially, they could be looking at serious counts like assault, harassment, and possibly charges related to filming and sharing the attack, though that remains to be seen. Law enforcement has been careful not to release the juveniles' names, but local news cameras did capture images of officers escorting young suspects in handcuffs into the station late Wednesday. Then, in a moment caught by local TV, the mother of two of the suspects actually showed up at the police station and publicly apologized for her children's actions. She was visibly distraught and telling reporters essentially that she just wanted to apologize to the family of the girl that got hurt in the video, saying, "I didn't mean for it to go this far. I'm sorry for my children's actions, and I hope you can forgive my kids." It's pretty rare to see a parent making a statement like that so soon, and it really just illustrates how intense the public pressure has been. These families know that the whole state and the mainland is furious at what happened. Meanwhile, the victim's family has confirmed that the 21-year-old woman does have special needs and had previously attended the same high school. Understandably, they are shaken and upset. The young woman was evaluated at a hospital after the attack, and thankfully reports indicate that she did not suffer life-threatening injuries, though she was bruised and, of course, traumatized. Support has poured in for her. Online fundraisers have been launched to help pay for any medical or counseling costs, and community members have been dropping off gifts and cards, and the outrage over bullying is a big part of why this story exploded. Fellow students at the high school told Hawaii News Now that they hope these arrests send a message that this kind of bullying won't be tolerated. And listen, I'm all for schools and officials denouncing bullying, but it doesn't really do shit. I think what matters at the end of the day is that you teach your kids to stand up for what is right and what is wrong. And it's going to be up to our kids to make the difference. And I know I sound like I'm on a soapbox right now, but it's passionate to me in my heart because literally last week, Jack, my son, who was 11 in fifth grade, just was crying because there's a girl in his class who was getting viciously bullied. And the girl finally stood up for herself. And then the girl got in trouble. And so Jack had to write a statement about what happened and said that she had every right to defend herself because she was witnessing these boys essentially bullying this girl relentlessly. And even my daughter has been physically assaulted while at school. And when she pushed back and defended herself, she got in trouble also. So, you know, I have a pretty cynical opinion when it comes to officials and administrators denouncing bullying and having no tolerance for bullying, because I think it's just BS. And I think what it really comes down to is parents at home making sure that they teach their kids the right things. And also setting examples, because if kids see their parents bully other people or talk about other people in a negative way or talk to their kids in a troubling way, then the kids are going to emulate that when they go to school. So ultimately, it's never going to change unless things change at home. So authorities and school districts can say whatever they want, but we know as parents that the schools don't actually tend to act because there's so much red tape. And then there's other parents that bitch and moan about their bully kids getting disciplined, God forbid. So I believe the problems exist at home, and it's probably time we start holding parents accountable for their kids' behavior, but that might be an isolated opinion. I don't care. It's mine. Moving on. You might not expect a health insurance CEO's murder to become a viral true crime obsession, but that is exactly what has happened in the case of Brian Thompson, the UnitedHealthcare executive who was gunned down in Midtown Manhattan late last year. The alleged killer is 26-year-old Luigi Mangione, and in the last couple of weeks, his case has taken some dramatic turns, including the feds seeking the death penalty and a bizarre social media fandom labeling him as an anti-corporate vigilante. To quickly recap, on December 4th of 2024, just as the sun was beginning to rise in Manhattan, 50-year-old Brian Thompson was shot dead in cold blood on a busy street outside of a hotel. The brazen broad daylight hit shocked the city, and within days, investigators honed in on a suspect, Luigi Mangione, a former University of Pennsylvania student from Maryland. On December 9th, just 5 days after the murder, Mangione was arrested hundreds of miles away in Altoona, Pennsylvania. When police picked him up, they found some wild stuff in his possession, one of which was a ghost gun, which is apparently a gun with parts that are made from a 3D printer to avoid identification. There was also a fake ID found in his possession, allegedly, and a handwritten manifesto-like note. According to police reports, that note railed against the health insurance industry, calling insurance companies parasitic and ranting about America's high health costs versus low life expectancy. Now, if that sounds extreme, it is. And authorities believe that Mangione targeted Thompson specifically because he was a health insurance CEO, essentially making a deadly political statement. Fast forward to spring of 2025, and Luigi's case is now in federal court. In April, a federal grand jury indicted him on 4 counts, including murder through use of a firearm, and 2 counts of interstate stalking, stemming from how he allegedly planned and traveled to kill Brian Thompson. Now, what really grabbed headlines was the Justice Department's stance. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi is pushing for the federal death penalty in this case. New York State does not have capital punishment, but because Mangione is charged federally for an alleged interstate and premeditated crime, the feds can seek execution. And Pam Bondi did not mince words. She called the murder, quote, a premeditated, cold-blooded assassination that shocked America, end quote, and tied the decision to pursue the death penalty to President Trump's agenda to crack down on violent crime. So yes, the political context is hard to ignore here. In this timeline, Trump-era law and order rhetoric is in play. Luigi Mangione was arraigned in Manhattan federal court on April 25th, where he pleaded not guilty to all charges. Observers outside saw something surreal: protesters and supporters with signs on both sides, some holding signs that said justice for Thompson, and others with messages like healthcare equals blood on their hands. It's not every day you see a murder suspect garner a political fan base, but here we are. So perhaps the strangest aspect is how Luigi Mangione has become a lightning rod figure on social media. In the immediate aftermath of Brian's killing, many Americans expressed outrage at the violence, but simultaneously a group of online voices, particularly on platforms like X or Twitter and TikTok and some other forums, bizarrely began lionizing Mangione as a kind of folk hero, striking back at big insurance. On Reddit, threads dissected his alleged manifesto, with some users calling him, quote, the first anti-healthcare industry vigilante. Then there was fan art that popped up depicting Mangione in a Guy Fawkes mask. It's really deeply unsettling, and the Thompson family has decried this glorification, reminding people that a real person, a husband and father, was killed. But still, the narrative took on a life of its own. The political divide further fueled it. Some far-left activists framed the case as symptomatic of a broken healthcare system, whereas many on the right and law enforcement see Mangione as nothing more than a dangerous extremist. With such intense public interest, the judge is treading carefully. In a hearing on May 5th, Judge Margaret Garnett actually chastised prosecutors and officials for making prejudicial public comments about Mangione. And this came after AG Bondi and others made very public remarks about the case. Pam Bondi's Instagram account even posted about seeking the death penalty. The judge reminded both sides that the defendant is presumed innocent until proven guilty and warned that trying the case in the media could hurt Luigi Mangione's right to a fair trial. In other words, dial down the rhetoric. The defense, for its part, filed motions arguing that Bondi's high-profile statements were poisoning the jury pool, and even claimed that the AG was using the case to boost her own profile, pointing to that Instagram post. Legal experts doubt the death penalty push will be dropped over this, but it does set the stage for a contentious trial. As of this week, no trial date has been set. Mangione's lawyers are reportedly considering a mental health defense, or at least presenting him as a man driven by irrational zealotry rather than pure malice, a strategy that I think is aimed at avoiding the death penalty. But time will tell, and I'll be here with all the updates. So make sure you are subscribed or following this podcast on whatever platform you're streaming from so that you don't miss future episodes or updates on this case and others. All right, brace yourself for this next one because it is a horrific tale out of Honia Path, South Carolina, that authorities are calling one of the worst cases of child and animal neglect that they've ever seen. It all started with a simple welfare check that turned into a house of horrors discovery. When police entered the home of Kayla Renard and Nicholas Foley last week, they were floored by what they found. An 8-month-old baby living amid over 40 animals running loose, surrounded by filth, feces, and even a dead goat decomposing in the bathtub inside the house. All of these animals are inside the house. The scene was so shocking that the police chief literally said it was one of the most horrific scenes he's witnessed in the 30 years he's had on the job. On May 21st, Tony and Path officers were dispatched to the home on South Shirley Avenue after the Department of Social Services, or DSS, got a tip or a complaint. As soon as officers stepped inside, it was like walking into a nightmare. There were piles of trash everywhere, the stench of urine and feces in the air, and animals scurrying around every corner. According to the police chief, Chris Miller, there were raccoons, chickens, cats, dogs, and rabbits roaming free inside the house, guys. Not outside, inside the house. In one bathroom, the carcass of a goat was found in the tub, in advanced state of decomposition. It had apparently been there for days, if not weeks. Animal feces littered the floors, and there was no sign of any area being cleaned or maintained. Amid this squalor, officers found the most heartbreaking sight, which was an 8-month-old baby crawling around in these conditions. It's really hard to imagine a baby living like that, exposed to waste, likely malnourished and unbathed, and at risk from the unpredictable animals that are surrounding this baby. I mean, raccoons. We have an 8-month-old amid raccoons and chickens and dogs and rabbits and a dead goat. The police immediately called in for backup for an emergency rescue operation. They carefully removed the baby from the home, and thankfully the child was alive and did not have obvious injuries, but certainly needed medical evaluation for potential infections or respiratory issues from all the ammonia smell and other things. But they also coordinated with animal control and local shelters to start rounding up all of the creatures. In total, over 40 animals were safely removed from the property. Some were in poor health. The raccoons had to be tested for rabies. The chickens and rabbits were dehydrated. Even the family's dogs and cats showed signs of neglect. So you can only imagine what this 8-month-old baby looked like. Both Renard, the mother, who was 28 years old, and Foley, the father, who was 38 years old, were present at the scene. Police noted something very eerie, which was that the parents seemed completely unfazed by what was happening. Chief Miller observed that they sat there calm with no facial expressions, even as officers were taking away their baby and discovering the horrific conditions inside. Like, you would think that they'd be upset, that they would know they were in trouble, but there was just no emotion. This cold demeanor disturbed the officers almost as much as the filth that surrounded them. Renard and Foley were promptly arrested. They've each been charged with unlawful conduct towards a child, essentially child abuse and neglect, and ill treatment of animals. Now, these are felony level charges. In South Carolina, unlawful conduct toward a child can carry up to 10 years in prison, and the animal cruelty charges could add on even more time. The infant, thank God, has been placed with a relative who is cooperating with DSS. Medical examinations are ongoing, and early reports suggested that the baby had some skin rashes and signs of developmental delay, which is really not surprising given the environment that this baby was living in. Neighbors were stunned by the news, and some told local reporters that they had no idea things were that bad inside of the house. Though a couple mentioned that they'd seen a lot of animals around the property, it seems the family kind of just kept to themselves, but one neighbor recalled hearing a baby crying sometimes, but never imagined that the living conditions were so horrifying. In hindsight, the smell around the property, especially with a dead goat inside of their bathroom, was a red flag. But neighbors a few houses down said that they could smell a foul odor, but thought that maybe a small animal had died under the house or something, not realizing that it was basically a makeshift zoo inside of their house. And we don't know if one of the neighbors ended up calling in the welfare check or if it was someone else. I would hope that a neighbor would say something, but hardened officers don't often get shaken. Honeopath PD did not hold back in expressing their disgust. Chief Miller said that this was the worst he'd ever seen in terms of combined child and animal neglect. Local media actually showed brief footage from an officer's body cam, with most of the visuals blurred for the viewer's sake, but you can hear one of the officers gagging and swearing under his breath as he steps through the trash and the excrement. Social media posts from the local news went viral nationally, and people dubbing Renard and Foley the raccoon hoarder parents and demanding maximum punishment. Yet thankfully, this story has a positive angle. The baby survived and is now safe. The little boy or girl, authorities haven't released the infant's name or gender for privacy, is now in a clean, caring environment. Doctors say that with proper nutrition and care, the child can recover from the early setbacks because babies are so resilient. And hopefully the baby doesn't remember any of this, but the community, once they got over the shock, has also been asking how they can help that baby and the animals. So there's been donations of diapers, clothes, and pet food have poured in to the local DSS and animal shelter. It's really heartwarming to see people rally after such a despicable situation. It kind of restores your faith in humanity a little bit. But this case is prompting discussions about mental health and hoarding disorders, because one of the big questions here is why? Why would two parents live like this with a baby in the home? Did they intentionally harm their child, or were they overwhelmed and suffering from mental illness? Some people who know the couple say that they had substance abuse issues. Others think that at least one of them might have a hoarding disorder or some paranoia that led them to keep so many animals. The investigation is still ongoing, and authorities will likely look into the parents' mental state. But regardless of explanation, the law is clear that a child cannot be subjected to such dangerous conditions. As Chief Miller said, quote, "Common sense was thrown out the window here," and the charges reflect that sentiment. The second week of the Sean Diddy Combs high-profile trial saw explosive testimony and dramatic moments in the Manhattan federal courtroom. By May 16th, the first week's star witness, Cassandra or Cassie Ventura, which was Sean's former longtime girlfriend, had concluded 4 days of emotional testimony. Cassie's time on the stand was gripping. She often fought back tears as she recounted years of alleged abuse, coercion, and degradation during her on-again, off-again 11-year relationship with Sean Combs. The defense's cross-examination, which was led by attorney Anna Estevao, tried to paint Cassie as a consensual participant in an unconventional lifestyle, highlighting loving messages that she once sent to Sean Combs and noting that she received a $20 million settlement in a 2023 civil suit. So we've heard about this civil suit before, and we never actually knew the settlement amount, but this was all regarding that video of her getting assaulted in the hotel. Cassie pushed back firmly, though, during her cross-examination, and in a heart-wrenching redirect on May 16th, she sobbed that she would give that money back if she never had to do freak-offs, referring to those drug-fueled sex sessions with hired escorts during the parties that Combs had forced on her. Observers in court, including Combs's mother and sons, as well as Cassie's husband, Alex Fine, looked on in silence as Cassie described feeling worthless, like she did not matter during the darkest times. It was an emotionally charged finale to her testimony, and even veteran trial watchers were taken aback by the raw detail and anguish that was on display. Cassie's departure from the stand wasn't the end of the week's drama, though. It was just the beginning. Moments after Cassie stepped down on Friday, prosecutors began calling a parade of new witnesses to corroborate and expand on her accounts. First up was Homeland Security Special Agent Yasin Binda, who helped execute the search warrant for Combs' arrest in September of 2024. Binda testified about items that were seized from Combs' residence that uncannily matched Cassie's stories, which of course were the multiple bottles of baby oil. And when I say multiple, I'm actually really understating that. It was like crates that you would buy at Sam's of baby oil and lubricant. There was also a special mood lighting device, illegal drugs, and even $9,000 in cash, essentially the toolkit that Cassie had described being used during the infamous freak-offs. Jurors were also shown photographs of these items, reinforcing Cassie's claims that Combs kept a steady and ready supply of sex paraphernalia and drugs on hand. This evidence bolstered the prosecution's depiction of Combs as orchestrating a prolonged drug-fueled sex trafficking scheme. Next on the stand was Don Richard, a singer from the group Danity Kane, which Combs formed on a reality TV show, and the trio Diddy Dirty Money. Dawn had her own lawsuit pending against Sean Combs, alleging a toxic work environment and abuse, and her testimony was brief but powerful. She recalled an incident that she says she witnessed at Sean Combs' house years ago. Cassie tried to cook eggs for Combs, but he became belligerent and erupted in violence. Dawn testified that Diddy grabbed a skillet and attempted to hit Cassie with it. Then, as Cassie dropped into a fetal position on the floor, he punched and kicked her repeatedly, eventually choking her and dragging her upstairs by her hair. She said that she was scared for her, that she had never seen anything like that, and described just how shocked she was at the brutality of it. This account visibly affected the jury. It also showed that Cassie's allegations weren't just coming from her alone. They were echoed by others in Diddy's circle. After the weekend, the trial's second week continued to deliver jaw-dropping revelations. On Monday, jurors heard from one of Diddy's former personal assistants, David James, who worked for the mogul from 2007 to 2009. James painted a picture of life on Diddy's payroll that ranged from lavish to dangerous. He dutifully set up hotel rooms with Diddy's personal items, including the baby oil, lubricant, condoms, snacks, and managed a medicine bag stuffed with ecstasy and Percocet pills for his boss. James also testified about a frightening encounter involving Marion, or Suge Knight, a known rival of Diddy. In 2008, James and a security staffer spotted Suge Knight at a Los Angeles diner and informed Diddy. According to James, Diddy ordered them to turn the car around and go back, and James noticed that Diddy had three guns on him as they headed to confront Suge Knight. Knight had left by the time that they arrived, but the incident left James shook up, saying, quote, "This was the first time as his assistant that I realized my life was in danger," end quote. James said he gave his notice to quit shortly after, unsettled by the lengths that Diddy would go in such situations. James's testimony also highlighted Diddy's alleged penchant for surveillance and blackmail. He described a New Year's Eve party where James himself took an ecstasy pill and danced uninhibitedly. Combs later showed James a video of that dancing and told him, "I want to keep this footage in case I ever need it." Now, this implication was clear. Even employees felt that Diddy might use compromising material against them, much as Cassie said he had done to control her. On cross-examination, the defense tried to chip away at James's credibility, noting small inconsistencies in his past statements about the Suge Knight episode. They even brought up an embarrassing incident when James admitted that he'd once gotten into a physical altercation with Diddy's personal chef, grabbing her wrists during an argument, to which Diddy admonished him, saying that you can't be putting your hands on a woman. The defense seemed to raise this to suggest that Diddy had some standards against violence, but it landed awkwardly given the context. It almost reinforced how chaotic Diddy's entourage life was and drew a contrast with the far more serious violence that Cassie and Don Richard described coming from Diddy himself. If the jury needed corroboration of Cassie's most explosive claims, Tuesday's witnesses delivered. Regina Ventura, which was Cassie's mother, took the stand on May 20th and revealed that she, too, had been ensnared in Diddy's web of intimidation. Regina testified that in December of 2011, Diddy was enraged to learn that Cassie was dating rapper Kid Cudi. Kid Cudi? Shoot, I'm really not sure how you say that. So that just proves how old I am. But apparently he demanded $20,000 to recoup money that he had spent on Cassie now that she was with someone else. Fearing for her daughter's safety, Regina and her husband took out a home equity loan to raise the cash and, following instructions from Diddy's bookkeeper, wired the money to Diddy. She said that she was scared about her daughter's safety, believing that the payment was essentially a ransom to keep Cassie safe. Notably, though, Diddy did return the money a few days later for reasons that are unknown, but Regina further testified that when Cassie came home for Christmas in 2011, she discovered bruises all over Cassie's body and took photos to document them. This was around the same time as the infamous incident that Cassie disclosed in court, where Diddy allegedly threatened to release explicit videos of her and have both her and her boyfriend harmed, even saying that her boyfriend's car would be blown up. In fact, Kid Cudi's car, sorry guys, did explode in his driveway soon after, an incident that prosecutors link to Diddy. I promise I don't mean to undermine the seriousness of all this. It's just when I read rappers' names and the names that they come up with, I can't help but think it's kind of funny. I mean, we're talking about a guy, Diddy, who changed his name like 17 times. And then another eye-opening witness on Tuesday was Sheree the Punisher Hayes, who is a male exotic dancer hired for many of the Freak Off sessions. So yeah, you'll have to excuse me when some of this stuff is just so ridiculous that you almost have to laugh at some of it. But testifying under a pseudonym, Hayes confirmed that he was paid to join 8 to 12 sexual encounters with Cassie and Diddy between 2008 and 2016. He corroborated details of these sessions, that Diddy was never intoxicated during them and was very much in control, giving directions throughout. Hayes perceived that they were performing to satisfy Diddy's fantasies, creating a scene that was enjoyable to her partner, as he put it. Crucially, Hayes noted that Cassie sometimes winced or sighed at the frequency of Diddy's instructions, suggesting that she was at least discomforted or weary, even if she didn't overtly protest. Like, you could just tell that she wasn't really into it, I guess. However, on a cross-exam, Hayes conceded that he personally never saw Diddy act violent towards Cassie during those sessions, nor did Cassie ever outright tell him that she was being hurt. The defense seized on that to imply that the freak-offs were consensual role-play, but the overall picture from Hayes aligned with Cassie's narrative that these were not spontaneous threesomes among equals, but carefully orchestrated performances directed by Combs. Wrapping up on Tuesday, the jury heard from HSI Special Agent Gerard Gannon, who led a March 2024 federal raid on Diddy's Miami Beach house. Gannon's team found a stash of weapons and other items that again echoed Cassie's allegations. He testified that parts of AR-15 rifles were found in Diddy's bedroom closet, notable given the allegations of Diddy brandishing firearms to threaten people. Jurors also saw photos of high heels, sex toys, lingerie, baby oil, and lubricants recovered from that raid, further cementing that Diddy maintained a well-stocked environment for the kind of sexual encounters that have been described in court. By Wednesday, May 21st, the prosecution's case was in full swing with even more insiders stepping forward. George Kaplan, another former assistant of Diddy from the mid-2010s, began testifying Wednesday afternoon. He recounted a 2015 incident in which he witnessed Combs get violent with Cassie. Diddy was being physically aggressive while his security team stood by and did absolutely nothing. In another occasion, Kaplan saw Cassie with visible injuries at Diddy's house, implying that he saw the aftermath of the abuse. He testified that he ultimately quit working for Diddy in late 2015 because he was, quote, not comfortable or aligned with the physical behavior that had been going on and refused to continue fixing those types of things, end quote. In other words, part of his job had been to clean up or cover for Diddy's misconduct, and he had just had enough. Kaplan even described an outlandish incident when he saw Diddy throw a number of green apples at another girlfriend in 2015 in a fit of anger. It was apparently so many apples that the woman had to shield herself with her arms. It's a strangely specific anecdote, but it underscores the volatile, unchecked rage that Kaplan says Diddy exhibited. Kaplan's testimony continued into Thursday, fleshing out the pattern of alleged abuse. Then the week's most anticipated witness took the stand on Thursday, rapper and actor Kid Cudi, Scott Mescudi. Okay, I actually looked it up how to pronounce it so that I would just stop fumbling it because he's mentioned so much. But Kid Cudi had been dragged into this saga due to his brief romantic involvement with Cassie. His appearance caused a stir, a famous recording artist testifying against another. Kid Cudi calmly recounted how in late 2011, he dated Cassie for a short time while she was on a break from Diddy. Cassie had confided in him that she was terrified of Diddy finding out. She even used a secret burner phone to communicate with Cudi, fearing Diddy's wrath. Indeed, when Diddy did discover their relationship, Cassie testified that he found an email, I guess, in December of 2011. All hell broke loose. Kid Cudi corroborated Cassie's account of the events that followed. One night in December of 2011, Cassie frantically called Cudi, sounding really stressed and scared, saying that Diddy had found out about them. Cudi then picked her up and they fled to a hotel. While en route, one of Diddy's employees called them, warning that Diddy and another man were at Cudi's house. Effectively, Diddy had sent people to break into Kid Cudi's home looking for him. Cudi testified that he even phoned Combs directly while driving home, and he answered the phone with an eerie calmness, saying, "I just want to talk to you." When Cudi cautiously returned home, Diddy was gone, but Cudi found his belongings rifled through and his dog locked in a bathroom, signs of an unlawful entry. Cudi immediately called the police and filed a report about the break-in. Then came the car bombing. Kid Cudi told the court that in January of 2012, shortly after that incident in December, his home was the site of a mysterious attack when his Porsche sports car went up in flames in the driveway. Photos shown to the jury revealed the car's convertible top had been sliced open and a Molotov cocktail was tossed inside, burning it from within. Cudi confirmed what had already been reported in the press. He absolutely believed this was the threat against him coming true. In fact, Cassie testified that Diddy explicitly told her, "I will blow up his car," when ranting about seeing Cudi and her together. And now here was Cudi under oath showing that someone did exactly that to his car. Prosecutors highlighted that LA authorities documented the fire as an intentional arson. A federal memo even alleges Diddy's co-conspirators carried out the deed and that Diddy later bragged about it. Diddy's lawyers, of course, deny that he had any involvement because they deny that he had any involvement in literally anything, but seeing Kid Cudi on the stand describing his shock and fear hammered home the prosecution's theme that Diddy abused, threatened, and coerced everyone around him to maintain power and silence. One almost cinematic moment came when lawyers sparred over whether Cudi could testify about the behavior of his terrified dog after the break-in. The judge quipped about Mascotti not being a dog psychic, as they decided to limit that line of testimony. But even so, the point was made that everyone and everything around this saga, down to the dog and the way that the dog was responding, bore the trauma of what had happened. Outside the courtroom, the public and media have been riveted. Each day's revelations trended on social media, and true crime podcasters and bloggers lined up early to get a seat in court. The image of music royalty on trial, Sean Combs, who is now 55, a multimillionaire mogul facing these lurid allegations, is itself pretty shocking, but it's the specifics that have people so floored. The notion of an international superstar allegedly running a personal sex trafficking ring under the guise of a swinger lifestyle, complete with the blackmail videos and hired sex workers, like, this case is absolutely bonkers. By the end of May 22nd, the trial narrative had shifted decisively in the prosecution's favor, at least in the court of public opinion, that is. In just that 1 week, jurors heard from former employees, friends, and family, and even an A-list rapper of whose name I can't pronounce, but I learned today. Anyway, all of whom, in one way or another, corroborated aspects of Cassie's disturbing story. There were shocking new revelations, which, with, of course, the apple throwing incident and the secret $20,000 payoff to Cassie's mom, and then more poignant moments of Cassie's tearful declaration of reclaiming her autonomy. The public reaction has been mixed of outrage and sorrow. Outrage at Diddy if these accounts are true, and then, of course, sorrow for Cassie and the other people who suffered at Diddy's hand. Online, many people have praised Cassie's courage for testifying in detail despite being 8.5 months pregnant, like right now. Others expressed shock that alleged crimes of this magnitude stayed under wraps for so long, hinting at open secrets in the music industry. And I've also seen people chastise Cassie for not coming out sooner or for putting up with it for as long as she did. And I think there's one meme that I've seen that really just encapsulates the message behind that whole theory, which is that so many of you who are chastising Cassie for not coming forward sooner or for putting up with it as long as she did, go get your nails done and don't speak up when the lady does your nails wrong. So I don't want to hear anybody chastise Cassie or judge her for not speaking up sooner when half of those people can't even send their food back when it's delivered to their table wrong. So moving on to the next story. Our last story comes from Mexico, when 23-year-old beauty influencer Valeria Marquez was murdered while she was live streaming. It was a crime whose horrific moment was witnessed by so many of her followers in real time. So Valeria was live streaming from Blossom the Beauty Lounge, her own beauty salon in Zapopan, which is a suburb of Guadalajara, on the evening of Tuesday, May 13th. Now, what began as a normal TikTok live session turned into a real-life nightmare. Seconds before the attack, Valeria, sitting at a table and clutching a stuffed toy, suddenly became alarmed, saying, "They're coming." Now, she said it quietly in Spanish, and her eyes were shifting towards the salon's entrance. Then you could hear a man's voice off camera calling out, "Hey, Vale," using a nickname for Valeria, to which she answered, "Yes," and those were her final words. Sensing danger, she actually muted her microphone but kept the video rolling. And then what happened moments later was beyond devastating to see. In real time, a man entered the salon and shot Valeria multiple times at close range, killing her on the spot. In the chaotic seconds that followed, the live stream camera toppled and blurred, and then a figure, presumably the shooter or an accomplice, appeared briefly on the video, picking up Valeria's phone and then showing their face on the screen for just a second before the feed cut out. The murder had literally just played out live on TikTok. And the video is circulating all over social media. I have seen it, unfortunately. And for those watching, disbelief and confusion quickly turned to horror. Viewers saw Valeria collapse on camera, and many initially weren't sure if it was some twisted prank or a real attack. The first shot, you could see her kind of like clutch her stomach or her ribcage area, and then it was pretty clear that she was also shot in the head. In the stream's final moments, you could see that Valeria had been handed two items by the intruder, a stuffed animal and a bag of Starbucks coffee. And these appear to have been ruses, props, maybe in a deadly ploy to get close to her. But authorities later confirmed what many had suspected, that the assailant posed as a delivery man bringing an expensive gift for Valeria. So earlier that day, Valeria had mentioned on live that an unknown person had come by the salon when she was out, claiming that they had a gift for her. And she expressed how concerned that made her, saying that maybe they were going to kill her. Literally, she said that nervously on the live stream in Spanish, but she asked, were they going to come and take me away or what? I'm worried. It was a chilling premonition. She knew something was off and voiced her fear just minutes before the gunman returned. And tragically, her instincts were correct. The motive and perpetrator of this brazen killing became the subject of intense speculation and investigation. From the outset, local authorities treated Valeria's murder as a likely femicide, meaning the killing of a woman specifically due to her gender or in a context of domestic violence. In Mexico, classifying a case as femicide triggers a special protocol recognizing that the crime may stem from issues like misogyny, intimate partner violence, or sexual aggression. The state prosecutor's office announced that it was following femicide protocols and had not ruled out any motives. They did not immediately name a suspect, but one widespread theory was that Valeria's ex-boyfriend was behind the hit. Mexican media even reported that Valeria had left messages indicating that if anything happened to her, she would blame her ex-partner. Indeed, the BBC confirmed that outlets had published such messages from Valeria prior to her death. Now, this pointed to the possibility that she had been threatened or abused by a former boyfriend and feared that he might make good on those threats. Many online commentators really ran with this narrative, speculating that Valeria's ex could have hired a hitman to kill her, which would align with how the killer didn't seem to know her personally, because the gunman asked someone, "Is this the one in the salon, Valeria?" as if verifying his target. Authorities later supported this line of thinking, and a spokesperson said, "It appears the shooter did not know her. You can deduce that this was a person who was paid to do it." Another rumor took a different turn, with some internet users claiming that Valeria's murder might be linked to a drug cartel, specifically the powerful Jalisco New Generation Cartel, or CJNG, which operates in that area. So this speculation grew so loud that the prosecutor's office publicly denied that a notorious cartel figure, Ricardo El Doble R. Ruiz, was a suspect. Officials made a call not to jump to conclusions and clarified that as of now, there are no direct accusations against any individual in the case. What we do know about the suspects is that thanks to surveillance cameras in the area, authorities obtained footage of the attacker's escape. Their governor, Pablo Limas Navarro, announced that city security cameras captured the assailants fleeing. They used two vehicles, a motorcycle and a white car, and then they split up on different routes after the shooting. So this indicates at least two accomplices were involved, and one of them might have been pictured on the live stream as they were turning it off. But by a week after the murder, however, no arrests have been made. Fans of Valeria have described her as a bright, kind young woman who loved sharing beauty tips and life updates with her fans. She had nearly 200,000 followers across TikTok and Instagram, making her moderately famous in the beauty influencer community. Her content was mostly makeup tutorials, product reviews, and glimpses of her daily life. To her followers, she felt like a friend, someone that they checked in on regularly. And that's partly why this case has struck a nerve. People witnessed the violent killing of a woman who was literally in the middle of doing what she loved. One moment she's just chatting about an eyeshadow palette or joking with viewers, and then the next she's terrified, and then the unthinkable happens right in front of you. Her fans have flooded Valeria's social media pages with condolences and outrage. TikTok later took down her account to stop the spread of the graphic footage of her killing. And at the time of this recording, investigators continue to pursue leads but have announced that they have no arrests. They're still examining the footage. They retrieved the stuffed toy and the coffee cup for potential evidence. And then, of course, Valeria's phone communications were taken too to piece together the plot. So I'm sure that this story will evolve and I will report on updates as they come. All right, guys, thank you so much for joining me for this week's weekly docket. I do apologize if towards the end it got kind of choppy. I am trying to record this while my kids are home from school and they keep interrupting me naturally because it's like the first day of summer. So I'm sure a lot of you stay-at-home moms or work-from-home moms can totally relate, but it just really impedes my ability to get things done the way I like them to get done. So, you know, just bear with me. I'm glad you stuck around and stuck through it. That is it for today's episode. And I'm going to really try hard to jump back on the Karen Reed trial as soon as I can just get a moment to catch my breath. I know there was a lot of stuff that happened this week. Judge Bev Cannone had to address the jury because of potential connections that she had to one of the witnesses, Julie Nagel. It's like a whole thing. And people keep texting me and they're like, have you seen this? Have you seen that? And I've seen it all. I just need a minute to actually organize my thoughts and then be able to sit down and record. But I promise I will soon. And I love you all so much for sticking with me. I appreciate you so much. Stay vigilant. Stay curious. Mama Mystery out.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. You chose to hit play on this podcast today. Smart choice. Make another smart choice with AutoQuote Explorer to compare rates from multiple car insurance companies all at once. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Affiliates. Not available in all states and situations. Prices may vary on how you buy.